Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Danny Putney, author of Salamat Sa Intersectionality, published by OK Donkey Press in 2021.
Book Tales, Reading, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today we are drinking an Angeligender, inspired by Danny's poetry collection. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog, link in the podcast description if you'd like to make one and have it with us.
For those not familiar with Danny's work, Danny Putney is a queer, non-binary, mixed-race, Filipinx, and neurodivergent writer originally from Sacramento, California. Their poems appear in outlets such as Empty Mirror, Ghost City Review, Glass, a Journal of Poetry, Juke Joint Magazine, and Tramp Set, among others, while their personal essays can be found in journals such as Cold Mountain Review and Glassworks Magazine. They received their MFA in creative writing from Mississippi University for Women and are presently an English PhD student at Oklahoma State University. While not always physically there, they permanently reside in the middle of the Nevada desert.
Salamat Sa Intersectionality is a lyrical triptych that traces the evolution of the speaker's identity as a queer, non-binary, mixed-race, Filipinx, and neurodivergent individual. Each panel of the speaker's life represents a distinct period of growth, a youthful beginning, which features important interactions with the speaker's parents, a sexually charged middle period that demonstrates the speaker's explorations of queer sexuality, and a contemplative third section, wherein the speaker reckons with their various selves. Imagery of the American West percolates throughout the collection to ground the speaker in their intersectional identity.
How are you doing today, Danny?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for asking, and I'm so glad to be on the podcast today. I'm actually sitting in my closet in the middle of the Nevada desert, so this is one of those times when I'm actually in Nevada, back from my PhD in Oklahoma.
Wow. Well, we're looking forward to talking with you about your work today and having you give us a reading a little later. Is giving live readings something you enjoy?
Yes, definitely. I feel that for me, as a more extroverted-minded person, I really love the energy that I can get from crowds, whether virtual or in person, and I really like being able to share my work in that direct way. Don't get me wrong, I love just reading and writing solo, but for me, part of what makes the gig of a writer so cool and appealing is that I actually get to be a people person and go to conferences and go to readings and actually interact with my fam.
Yeah.
Now, how have you found doing Zoom readings different?
Oh, I think it's been fine. In some ways, it's actually better because I can just log in from wherever after doing whatever and just start my reading or join whatever roundup of readings that has been posted. Most of the readings I've been doing have been kind of a mix of people. So it's not just me, it's me and three other people. And I've really liked that because I think it's trying to replace the community aspect of it. I have had solo readings, and that's totally fine, especially if it's accompanied by a question and answer session and I get to actually talk about my book. But yeah, for me, Zoom has been a benefit in many ways because I am a very busy person. But of course, you can never take away that energy, that feeling from a live reading. So I definitely appreciate that those are starting back up in some form.
Yeah, me too. Can you tell us a little bit about the poems in Salamat Sa? If there was one poem that shaped the collection and how you put them together and how they connect?
Sure. The poems actually started in this section, believe it or not. Those were the earliest poems I wrote toward the end of my undergraduate career and leading into my MFA. And so I was thinking that I would write a poem, or rather a poetry collection that was centered around queer sexuality. And then in my MFA, with the help of lots of cool professors, some people of color, other queer folks, I started to explore different facets of my identity, and I started to really come into my non-binary identity. I actually never publicly said I was non-binary until 2017. It was something that was kind of like a slow burn. It was something that I came into over time, like a gradual evolution, and it just became more clear to me the more I wrote poetry about it and the more I tried to explain, you know, this complex identity that I hold within me that not always people can see. And so,
yeah.
I started to write the third section and the first section, exploring my non-binary identity and my mixed race identity. That was something that I hadn't written about a lot prior to my MFA, but it started to become more important to me the more I tried to reclaim my Filipinx heritage, especially considering how whitewashed my youth was and how my late father prevented my brother and me from learning Tagalog. And a lot of the interactions we had with our culture was through food or maybe friends who were mixed race or who were full-blooded Filipino. And so writing became a really important tool for me to explore that part of my heritage. And so I wrote all of these other poems around it. And then I just decided that I wanted it to be this hodgepodge of all the facets of my identity, but I wanted to put my whole intersectional self out there. And it's funny because some of my early feedback kind of try to steer me away from that. You can't write about all of these different things. But then I was like, well, I'm all of these things all the time. So I can't just curate it in such a way that I'm not going to write about my queerness in relation to my Asian identity or my non-binary identity in relation to my neurodivergent identity, for example. So I just wanted to go all the way and really embrace this messy, complex self that I am. And it ended up working out because I'm talking about it now on this podcast.
Ah, that's right.
Well, that's awesome. Related to becoming a poet, though, this is kind of a two-part question. Did you always imagine you'd be a poet, or did you kind of come to it later? And what for you informs your decision towards a new collection in general?
Great questions. For the first part, I want to say hell no. I actually didn't start writing seriously until I was 17, which actually isn't too late if you think about it. But having a lot of friends who realized they loved writing at like 5 or 6 years old, it made me feel kind of like I was geriatric. Mm-hmm. But it's a funny story. I actually wrote my first poem because I was in love with a boy named Matt in high school during my senior year. And I remember writing it in green ink. And it was a ridiculous kind of fandom-based love poem because we shared a lot of fandoms like Supernatural and Doctor Who. So I had lots of references to those things. And even though that didn't work out, he's married to this wonderful woman and he's now an engineer and for all of these things, right? It really jump-started my poetry career because I realized that I loved writing poetry after that. And I've been doing poetry pretty seriously ever since. I'm 25 now, so it's not like I've been, you know, around the poetry block for too long, but I've definitely not looked back ever since I wrote that first poem. And it's funny too, because I did all the science classes, like all the AP and honor science classes in high school, was really, really good at it, loved learning about science. I actually didn't really have to take any science classes in undergrad because I got all my credits taken care of because I was a little smarty. But then I realized, you know, after writing that poem, and reflecting on just all the writing I had done before and how good I actually was at it, that this was something that I needed to pursue. And so I quickly changed my major to English when I matriculated at my undergraduate institution. So I'm really glad that I was able to have that revelation pretty early on because I didn't have to, you know, spend like 2 years of my college career trying to find myself. I was able to have that reckoning before college even started. But then the second part of the question, how I shape a collection or how I start thinking about that, I generally have some sort of itch that I'm trying to scratch. And my second collection is tentatively titled Mix Mix, which is actually the English translation of a dessert called Holo Holo. And it's actually a dessert name that I'm getting tattooed on my knuckles in a couple of weeks, just so that I can remind myself of the mixture of my identity, right? But that collection is going to more seriously and thoughtfully interrogate my mixed race identity. But like I said before, because I'm living at the intersection of all of these different marginalized identities, it's not like I'm going to disregard my queerness or my non-binary identity in that collection. And in fact, in many of the poems in that collection so far, those things kind of naturally weave into my identity. For example, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Andrew Cunanan. He was this really big serial killer who was mixed race.
Oh, wow.
He was a mixed race Filipinx just like me. And he had all of these sugar daddies. He was queer, but he was also mentally unstable. And he ended up killing, I believe, 5 people, maybe 6. And he ended up killing himself after that. And so that's a topic that naturally integrates my queerness with my mixed race Filipinx identity. And I don't think I'm a serial killer, but just being able to connect with this person in history and being able to see how he has been wronged and how it's kind of a nature versus nurture thing. Like, he was almost, not to defend him, but he was almost put into a position such that murder would be like the only way for him to live a life, being queer and mixed race Filipinx and being marginalized in so many different ways. I mean, if you guys want to check it out more, it's actually a really wonderful series that's produced by the folks who did Pose and Glee. And
oh,
I forgot what it's called. Oh, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, because that's the most famous person he murdered. And it stars Darren Criss.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And I just watched the Pose series, actually, which was like almost like a fictional retelling of the Paris is Burning type documentary, right? Are we thinking of the same thing? Yeah, fantastic. So I'm so fascinated. And I also watch a lot of shows with serial killers too. So maybe we'll check that out. That'll be interesting. I want to talk about a different aspect of the poems that kept occurring to me. And it's probably because I'm in sunny Southern California here. So I'm always fascinated when there are evocations of the West, the idea of the West, either West Coast or any aspect that particularly shows up in literature. I really love the poem Mountain Coda and how it evokes the idea of creating a better West. But I want to parse this with you. What do you mean by West? Can you speak to the white space you wanted to leave the reader with by evoking the West in the last line?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. For me, the West that I'm referring to is the American West that is Colorado westward. That's the West that I'm deeply familiar with and have lived in most of my life, growing up part of a time in California, and then the second part of my adolescence in Nevada. And of course, just exploring different areas of the West too, like Idaho, which I deeply love, and Oregon and Arizona, et cetera, all of these wonderful states. And so for me, I wanted this physical landscape to be the sort of map for my journey of uncovering and evolving into my intersectional identity. Because as you guys wonderfully read at the beginning of the podcast, all of these poems are set against this really important backdrop of the West, more so that it's actually a character, I believe, in this collection. And so I wanted people to think about me as this queer, non-binary, mixed race Filipinx, and neurodivergent individual experiencing all of these things within the deserts of Nevada and the mountains and the dry heat and all of these things that have been a very big part of my life, just visually. And for me, I think that having that invocation with my frontispiece poem, Mountain Coda, was the best way to do that. And I like that you mentioned the white space too, because the white space allows folks to bring in their own conceptions of the West, whether that be stereotypical or maybe they're from the West, like you're in Southern California, maybe you're deeply familiar with it and you can actually put some of those images to the page with me. But of course, as the collection progresses, there are distinct images and distinct places that the speaker in the collection is actually interacting with. So even if you're from the East Coast and have never stepped foot in Nevada, you'd be able to see a little bit of what I'm seeing through my eyes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Danny, a word that rises up when I read your poems is biologically inclined. The idea of a poet using nature as the metaphor in so many poems. Do you have a biological science background? I'm thinking of the Darwinian reference, the role that land plays in many of the poems around the narrator and those around the narrator.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned this because I was kind of going on a tangent earlier about my science background. So this is a perfect place to really insert that piece of knowledge that I have. I did want to become a biologist, or as a lot of Asian kids are encouraged to become, a doctor or something in the medical field. And I really loved all of my biology classes. I aced them, aced the AP biology exam. That was actually the first major that I had declared before going into college. It was biology. And I thought that at the very least, I'd work in a lab or do something with the natural sciences. So biology has been a very important part of my scientific background. And I've loved learning about organismal biology. Don't get me wrong, I love microbiology too. And I love learning about nature at a cellular level. But I love learning about the different organisms that exist in our world and in our universe, rather. And just seeing how their biological systems operate and how maybe in comparison to humans, we're not all too different, especially if you look at it from a microbiological level and you can see a lot of the similar processes happening in life.
Yeah, definitely. As a Californian, which I mentioned before, I have to say, I also notice how California plays a role in a lot of your poems, from one that's set in Sacramento to the other with the Californian allusions. Can you speak to how California may have shaped your poetics or been involved with decisions you make?
Sure. A lot of those poems that mention California specifically are actually, they're actually based in my childhood in California, because I moved out of California around middle school age. And that's when I started, you know, middle school and high school in Nevada. But California is definitely seared into my memory forevermore, right? It's always something that I'm thinking about. And just thinking about the Northern California landscape specifically, because that's what I'm mostly familiar with. I'm originally from Sacramento. That's something that I wanted to have play a role in my poetry. And so when I think about my poetics and when I think about place, I definitely can't escape the smells of the pine forests of Tahoe or the Central Valley that surrounds California, and how it's a kind of mix of Napa Valley-esque greenery, but also kind of the, what some would argue would be drab modernity of the highways that cuts through the Central Valley as well. And one of the poems I wrote called Frogs is set in this really beautiful lake and camping site called Frenchman's Lake, but it's called Frenchman. And that's the place that we'd go to and just camp at and have fun at. We ended up frog hunting. And so that's where that poem came from. And so for me, California is kind of a mix of memory, but also place and just themes that I continue to return to in my poetry. I don't think I can ever escape that, no matter where I am physically. I mean, even with Nevada, Nevada has a lot of similarities to California. It's very different, of course, but I feel like when I'm thinking about the West, I definitely have California and Nevada in my mind.
Interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I mean, this is interesting to me because, you know, I live in San Diego, about half an hour north of the Mexican border, about 2 hours south of Los Angeles. And so much literature about California seems to always situate itself in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles. So I always get excited when I see an author featuring different parts of California that I see less often in literature. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't often see Northern California represented, especially because it's very different from Southern California. And don't get me wrong, I love Southern California, but just when you compare the valley to the other valleys that exist, you know, that aren't named because they're not the capital V Valley, it's a very different experience.
It's like people's mind darts right from Los Angeles to Portland, Oregon, or I don't know, or Los Angeles to Seattle, Washington. You know, it doesn't seem like there's as much literature in that particular area of California. And I lived in Modesto for a couple of years, so I think there's a lot of really fascinating stuff that can be written about that area, but I don't see it as often. So anyway, that was just my little point there.
You talked earlier about how your Filipinx heritage features in your poetry. And I wanted to kind of come back to that and ask if you could talk a little bit more about that, about how having a diverse background has shaped you as a poet and has informed your poetry.
Yeah, I think it really boils down to a cellular level. When I think about writing poetry, I don't ever disregard my mixed race Asian American identity. I just feel that every word that I write onto the page, every theme I explore, whether it's, you know, about my identity specifically or something else, I just always carry that with me. I actually started to intentionally write about my mixed race identity in my MFA, as I said before. And my mom has been a very important part of that process coming into reclaiming my identity, for example, because after my father passed away, I really started to bond with my mom. We're actually really close friends now, and I'm glad for that. So if anything good happened out of my dad's death, it was that now I'm super close with my mom in a way that I had never been before. And part of that is learning more about my heritage and her heritage, our shared heritage, and more intentionally engaging with memories of her past, of Cebu in the Philippines, and seeing where I connect and where I fit into that narrative of her life. I've been seeing how that's been kind of distilled in America after she immigrated. I've been also dealing with a lot of the issues that Filipinos in general might experience, like colorism, racism more broadly, and then, of course, fetishization and colonization. And these themes definitely trickle into my research, too, as a PhD student. But the thing that really pushed me forward in writing about my identity was that one poem, My Mom Was a Picture Bride. That was the first time I'd really seriously delved into my identity in relation to my mom and in relation to what I'd call intergenerational trauma and inherited baggage. After I wrote that, I felt, I don't know, really empowered, I think is probably the best word to use. And I knew I had to continue to write about it. And also, it makes me happy knowing that my mom actually likes these poems. I've shown her pretty much most, if not all, of the poems that feature her or that talk about her. And I'm glad to have her support, however small, in some way, because it makes me feel like I'm not just using her, you know, because you can definitely read work where it features a family member or a friend or something, and it feels like they're just taking their story. But for me, it feels like it's been a real dialogue between my mom and me, and I just happen to be a scribe. But more than that, I'm also distilling it from my own perspective, my own unique set of subjective experiences. So it's my story too. That's an insecurity that I've definitely had to work through, but I feel a lot better knowing that my mom supports me and that she actually is a huge presence in my work.
Thank you for sharing that.
That's so beautiful. I love that. I know so many authors feel kind of afraid to show their parents their work. So it's kind of lovely that it's become a point of intersection for you and your mom. So this is not related to the issue of family reading work, but it's related to the issue of the generation of work through the feeling of connection to other authors. So I wanted to ask you today, who are your favorite poets? This is kind of a long question, so hang in. Are there any you started with and then others you grew into, including in your mental library? I note that the poems, literary sources, and inspirations are cataloged at the end of this collection. So can you tell us how or why you made the decision to include this list and then just kind of speak about the poets who are really in your image repertoire?
Yeah, it's definitely evolved over time. So I sort of have to give a little bit of a trajectory here. But first, the poets who really spoke to me when I was 17, 18, you know, after writing about that boy, after really coming into poetry, were Sylvia Plath, Mary Oliver, you know, folks like that. I would even put Gertrude Stein in there. Just people who are really famous, more modern, a little postmodern poets that probably everybody is familiar with. And with me, Sylvia Plath was the first poet that I saw write about neurodivergence in a really compelling, beautiful way. And so she's stuck with me ever since. And I actually have a tattoo of her face on my thigh, as I do with Virginia Woolf.
Oh my.
So the title of that poem, Sylvia Plath and Virginia Woolf Talk on My Thighs, is quite literal. I do have their portraits looking at each other across my thighs. But those two authors are super big for me. I know that Virginia Woolf's a fiction author, but she was queer, and just the way that she experimented with form is something that I've always carried with me going throughout my literary career. And then, of course, as I started to take poetry workshops and just creative writing workshops in general and be exposed to more of the community members, especially the living community members in poetry world, I started to get into folks like Ocean Vuong. His novel On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous is probably the best novel that has ever been written. I'll die on that sword because I think it's so poetic and beautiful and experimental and lyrical that I just don't see happen a lot in traditional novels. But also his poetry itself is very beautiful, and just how he writes about his queerness and his Asian American identity and the intersection thereof really speaks to me. But along the same lines, this poet, Hugh Minh Nguyen, he is also a Vietnamese American queer poet. His poetry has really spoken to me, and especially the poems he writes about his mom and how he connects or disconnects from his mom in the kind of tensions and perhaps reconciliations that exist between them. That has really been a great reflection for me to see when I read about my mom. So those are a couple of the contemporary voices that I really am drawn to today. But just a shout out to some other poets that I enjoy. I really like Paige Lewis. They're a non-binary poet who's come onto the scene recently. Their book was Space Struck. I really enjoyed them. And of course, they use they, them pronouns. I enjoy Franny Choi, another queer Asian American poet. I really enjoy Danette Smith because who cannot love Danette Smith? And I want to shout out a few of my friends too, like Remy Recchia and Rosanna Alice Boswell. They're two of my peers at the PhD program in Oklahoma, and their books that have been recently released are amazing, and they really push me, and I am deeply inspired by them every day. But besides that, I want to give credit to some non-poet people out there. I actually am a big fan of comics, and so Versus One comic book series created by Noelle Stevenson called Lumberjanes that has been a really big part of my life, and I always get the new compilation of issues whenever they drop. It's almost finished, but I really love reading it because it's this young adult series set in this feminist, women-focused camp during summer. And then it has this whole ragtag crew of like queer people, people of color, non-binary people. And it's just been really cool to see that from a young adult perspective. And even though I don't really engage in the comics genre at all, just having that kind of idea of inclusivity at the back of my mind has been really important for me thinking about my own work and how I want to represent myself and be part of larger conversations and communities.
Yeah, I also notice the appearance of Freud, Lacan, Judith Butler in your creative process. So kind of like philosophical impulses, psychological impulses, as well as kind of a literary criticism piece. How do you feel your work is influenced by or referential to literary criticism? Is there an element of the scholar poet in your poet's identity?
Oh, most definitely. The scholars that you've mentioned and who appear very intentionally throughout my collection are very, very dear to me. I had a kind of coming into myself through scholarship, as I think a lot of marginalized folks do, especially when it comes to queer theory. So folks like Judith Butler, Michel Foucault, even Jacques Derrida, they've all been very influential to how I see the world and how I use theory to just make sense of the world. Because for me, my kind of ontology and epistemology is one of interpretivism. So I just believe that the world is something that can only be really seen through subjective experience. And that's how we have to communicate our quote unquote findings about the world through our subjective experiences. And I think that really marries well with how I view myself and my intersectional identity, because I have all these lived experiences that can be often invisible or that people don't see, but I really viscerally feel them all the time, right? And so even in my second collection, I'm looking at art historical research because that's my secondary emphasis in my PhD program. It's in Southeast and East Asian art history. So I'm using art history as a kind of springboard to think about my work in a more critical way. But I'm also looking to the historical archive and what I can uncover from that archive, especially when there's been so much silencing of queer and Asian American voices in the Western canon, for example. So I really turn to that sort of vein of scholarship to inform my work. But of course, the big bads, as we've mentioned, are always going to be with me. I can never, you know, not credit Butler. I even have a personal essay that directly responds to something that Judith has written. And I also love some of the kind of pessimistic folks. They appear in my collection too, but it's folks like Lee Edelman, who wrote The Future is Kid Stuff. And it's this kind of really, I think the word I want to use is lambaste, because he really goes against this idea of heteronormative child rearing and the idea of this phantasmagoric child informing policymaking and then that really affecting queer people's lives in detrimental ways. And he's kind of like a pessimistic type of person in the queer theory field. But then there are folks like Leo Persani too, who wrote this awesome article called Is the Rectum a Grave, which I mentioned a bit in the notes section of my book. But that's basically about how the power of queer, and in this case, male sexuality, often comes from a sense of powerlessness and giving yourself up to this kind of ecstasy, this jouissance that can be reached through anal receptive sex. And there's actually this kind of really big internalized homophobic part that comes into play when men don't want to be penetrated because they're trying to hold on to this sense of agency that really can be antithetical in terms of sexual pleasure. It's a really kind of dense and weird thing, but it's something that's really stuck with me for a long time. And it's something that I often return to in my work. And of course, it appears in the poem Jouissance because that's the whole basis of the poem. But yeah, I can't thank scholarship enough And I continue to go down the rabbit holes of scholarship. Just being in the PhD program has been very, very beneficial to me spiritually, because scholarship has always been a part of my life. And I know a lot of people, especially writers, don't like scholarship because it can be dense and it can be inaccessible. But for me, that's where I feel like there's a lot of queer possibility and freedom, because I can bits and pieces of what these scholars are saying and then redeploy them for my own kind of selfish writing purposes. And by selfish, I mean, you know, how do I come into my identity? How do I see myself in the world? And so maybe it's not really selfish, but I'm just using it in such an individualized way. I don't think I can really do that with anything else besides scholarship. And so in that way, I kind of follow in the footsteps of folks like Maggie Nelson, who writes beautiful creative criticism. And whenever I write nonfiction, I always think of Maggie Nelson, because for me, the prose form is another way I can really bring in and extrapolate my scholarship and scholarly knowledge and connect it to whatever thing I'm writing about, and then make it this kind of literary beast that just happens to exist. So I want to shout out Maggie Nelson as well.
Yeah, I'm with you on scholarship. I really love it. And honestly, there's nothing better than going down a rabbit hole of scholarship and just spending the day or hours in books and articles. I love that too. I wanted to talk to you about this sort of fearless eroticism in your poetry and a lot of your poems, perhaps the romanticization of the male form and reverence for that. I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit about that and also what themes define your poetry.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I feel like for me, the romanticization aspect is something that I intentionally included, because I feel like the male form isn't often seen as beautiful. And so just even including something about a tiny urine stain on somebody's like underwear and seeing that as something like as an opening for sexual pleasure, that was something that I intentionally included, because I feel like in our society, it's changing a little bit. Like we have folks like Chris Pratt who have like publicly stated that it's okay to objectify men nowadays. And I can't agree more, right? I feel like there's no such thing as like reverse objectification, because like men have hegemony in our society. So it's not like, you know, objectifying a man is actually going to cause him any harm. But that's kind of an aside. I just feel like in our society, in many societies, we're not allowed to see men as beautiful, especially when it comes to things like body hair or body odors or just the way that men carry themselves in the world. And so I wanted to highlight that. But of course, at the same time, that's all very part of my queer awakening and exploration, right? I am, you know, sexually attracted to these men and I'm having sex with these men. And so how do I reconcile these things I'm feeling in my brain about their bodies and with my desire and with what we may or may not do sexually? And that's how the whole second section just kind of operates. And it's funny because, like I said, that was the first section I wrote. And so for me, my sexual awakening is more of something that I feel like I've already done. Of course, we're always evolving into our sexualities. We're always learning more about our sexualities. But for me, that seems like the thing I'm most distant to, because I feel like I kind of quote unquote figured out my sexuality first. But I mean, of course, it's still very present in my work today. But it's just, I just bring that up because it's a little funny talking about it when I feel like that's something that isn't as present when it comes to my writing today as it was, you know, maybe 5 years ago. But with that fearless eroticism part, I really like that you phrase it that way, because I feel like talking about these things in such open, direct ways can be an invitation for ridicule or harm or insults or whatever sort of bad thing you want to insert there. And so I'm glad that it's been received positively, because I think a lot of people shy away from sex or writing about sex because of the potential consequences. But for me, the liberative power is in talking about it honestly and vulnerably, especially when it comes to queer people and queer bodies, right? If we don't talk about it, then people aren't going to be able to move past the stereotypes of what it means to be queer in America. Like, this is what queer sex can look like, or what queer romance or queer desire can look like. And so for me, it's important to include that in my work so that people can be exposed to it, but also because this is something that I'm dealing with and I need to write about it.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because in certain respects, I think writing sex into poetry gives you more freedom and liberation than writing sex into prose, where people are likely to try to slant you into an erotic fiction genre or something of that nature. I'd wonder if poets have more freedom because of the way that people try to put genres on people writing in the prose area. But I've experienced that too. In literary fiction, there's a sort of elitism against including sexual graphic content. It's all very interesting. One thing that occurred to me with your work, though, when I was reading it very, very closely, is for me, because I can read sex all day, but for me, what comes to me is the kind of poignancy of some of the scenes and things that you were depicting, themes of stolen youth, maybe youth taking advantage of by older men, kind of recurred in the work in different manifestations, the cowboy, the professor, the lover of old couples in the bathroom stalls. Is the theme of stolen youth or innocence important to your work?
Most definitely, yes. And that really factors, or that really comes alive in the sex poems in the middle section, because I'm interacting with men who have a power advantage over me, and I'm choosing to be there, and I'm giving myself up. But then when it comes to how I feel psychically or emotionally afterward, or even during, what does that mean to give up something to these men? What does it mean for that to be part of my sexuality? And that's something that I'm dealing with to this day, as somebody who, you know, has these lifelong daddy issues and is trying to parse out how those issues really factor into my sexuality and how I exist as a sexual being. But it's funny because when I think about sex, it's never just about sex for me. And that's why I wanted to write about it. It's all of the things around sex, or what the sex may mean for the speaker or the lover or the beloved. What does having sex on a dirty futon in an abandoned trailer mean for the speaker when the speaker is coming into their sexuality and they're having sex with a kind of repressed cowboy type? What does it mean for both of them? And what does it mean that this, why is the speaker doing it? What do they want out of it? And what is their beloved getting out of it? And why is the speaker drawn to such a character? But conversely, why is the speaker drawn to somebody who might be older and more experienced? And are we trying to get them to show something to them? Are we trying to replicate a relationship they had with their dad? Are we trying to fill a gap or a hole in their spirit? Is there something that they feel is stolen from them that they're trying to reclaim, like with the stolen youth? Is there something there that can be uncovered? And of course, I don't really have any answers to these things, but these are the things I think about and what drives some of these poems, like just the things that have led me to some of the decisions I've made, that have led to some of the situations I've been in. And of course, it's not always like I'm making agent of decisions all the time. Like sometimes I get put into situations and you have to deal with that. And sometimes those poems arise too, like the Texas Tango poem. That's something that I got put into, right? It wasn't something I chose to do. But I think what connects all of these experiences is that there's something going on at a deeper, more psychic level in relation to the sex. And I think that's probably why a lot of sex goes awry when it's written about in literary fiction or even in poetry, because it's not often, or at least I don't often see it be more about what the sex means. And I think this is particularly true when I read straight sex. And this is probably just my personal opinion, but like, I feel like it's a lot harder to write about straight sex successfully because there's often not a clear political dimension or a clear identity-focused dimension to it when I read about straight sex. But when I read queer sex, well, every single person I've read write about queer sex has done so in a way that is deeper than the actual sex. And so I kind of fit into that lineage of writing about sex, but for political and personal and identity-focused purposes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I definitely could hear that coming through. And I think that's a relevant point you're making. Well, speaking of which, we are so looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Salamat'sa Intersectionality. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called an Agella Gender, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here's the ingredients. It is 2 ounces of gin infused with Earl Grey tea, 1 ounce of Saint Germain, 1/2 ounce of Grand Marnier, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup, and then oat milk, which I love being in this recipe. You put everything in a shaker with ice, give it a little shake, and strain into a glass. Danny, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the poems you're going to be sharing with us today?
Yeah, just to give a little roadmap, I'm kind of this really planned person, so I hope you'll suffer me explaining these a little bit, but I'm going to read a bit of each section. So there are 3 sections that form the triptych of this book, and so I'm going to read 2 from the first, 1 from the second, and 3 from the last. And I wanted to end with more at the last section because that's the synthesis section. That's where all of these different facets of the speaker's identity is coming into play in really beautiful amalgamized ways. And so that's how I'm going to read today. Just wanted to give you a heads up. And also a heads up, I'm going to provide a little bit of backstory before each poem too. That's generally how I read my work. So just know that when I stop a poem and I start talking kind of informally, that's, you know, something I naturally do.
Okay, that sounds great.
Great, then we're ready. Go ahead and take it away.
Okay, so the first poem I'm going to read is Mountain Coda, and I'm glad we actually got to talk about it because this is a poem that I definitely wanted to open my book. As I've mentioned before, it's the invocation for the speakers coming into their identity in the West, and it creates this space for readers to imagine what that West may be, who may populate it, and how the speaker interacts with the West. And so I intentionally moved this poem to what would be called the frontispiece section. So it's before every single section of the book. And I feel like it's a great way to invite readers into this queer little Western world that the speaker is inhabiting, but also creating their own image as well. So without further ado, this is Mountain Coda. Dragon breather, exhale across the great chasm, burn my body into existence. Sculpt me from dirt under your tail. Watch me materialize from dust. Conjure earth fossa, your escarpment ally. Round my curves toward the tip of galaxy's thumb. Crack my bones into place. Let valleys echo my spine. Lead coda 1, 2 along thoracic vertebrae. Imbue my joints with musical sierra. Drown my baby lungs with snow melt. Glacial cannibalism at its finest. Kill me as you fill me with mountain water. Behold your work after final breath. Scoff for the wayward, leeward life you birthed. Do it again to create a better West. Okay, now this next poem I'm going to read is in Youthful Absolution, the first section of my book. And it's inspired by this Asian Ghosts panel I went to in 2019 at the Portland AWP. And that really inspired me to continue to write about Asian ghosts. That's something that I never really thought about, even though I live every day feeling haunted by the trauma that my mom has experienced in the Philippines and in America, the trauma that my ancestors have experienced through colonization, and how I kind of fit into that picture as a mixed race individual who is the product of miscegenation enforced through colonial rule. And so this was kind of the first like introduction to me writing about Asian ghosts. And now I can't stop writing about it. So this poem is Philippine X. Ghosts swim across the Pacific, say hello through my tap. Outside Talisay City, water is polluted. Human feces, urine from untreated septic tanks. They came to warn me. I also think they came to bring me cancer. Half my mother's siblings have died from shapeless facial tumors. She never bathed in the sea. Her parents knew the water was never safe. When I fear the lump on my neck has metastasized, I know I'm my mother's child. Death by cell overgrowth would mire me in ancestral love, dispel earthly doubts I was never Asian enough. I wrap my mouth around the faucet, mix spirits with saliva, gulp years of heritage down my throat. And now we're moving on to my sexy slash slutty section, which is actually my favorite section. And as I mentioned before, this is the first part of the book I wrote because coming into my queerness, my sexuality was one of the earliest things that was part of my journey in terms of identity and evolution. And so I'm actually going to read the very last poem of this collection, or rather this section, because I feel that it's a great sort of summation of some of the themes that happen in this section about giving yourself up to men, sometimes older men, the power play, the power reversal, what it means to be found in these sorts of situations, to desire these men, to romanticize these men. So I feel like Jouissance is a really great composite of all of these things happening in this section. Jouissance. My body is a grave where I'm reborn as goddess of pleasure. I want him inside me. I want to become him. My body trembles as his hand glides along my spine. I lean into calloused palm, worker's touch, hardness alive with memories of power tools, lumber, too much dirt. I tongue sweat off his digits, think about the whole spelunked. My DNA forges a cosmos of possibility within his pores. connected by touch. Master, master, master me, please. Excavate and refill over and over. And now on to the final section, which is called Taken Root. As I've mentioned before, this is a synthesis of all of the things and themes that are occurring in this book. It's where queerness and my mixed race identity and non-binary identity, as well as neurodivergence, all kind of come into the fray and interact with each other in very meaningful, intentional ways. It's not like those things aren't interacting with each other throughout the book. I'm always an intersectional self, but I wanted to write this section and end on this section because I want to show folks that these disparate or seemingly disparate aspects of my identity really do interact with each other all the time. And so the first poem I'm going to read is actually based on an online quiz I took to determine what my non-binary identity is. And I remember taking this quiz kind of jokingly back in 2019 when I was more fully coming into my non-binary identity. And even though it was a joke, I kind of still vibe with it and still feel like maybe I'm this angelic presence. I always kind of tell people that I'm this cosmic being made of stardust that has a body, but my gender and my spiritual self are larger than any one body can contain. And maybe that might annoy some folks. I know that some trans folks, for example, don't like the use of metaphor so much to describe their genders. But for me, I feel like metaphor, especially when it comes to something like angelogender, is the perfect way for me to describe the complex, almost ineffable facets of my gender identity. So without further ado, here's angelogender. The online quiz assigns, after I select A, robes of cosmic energy, B, color of the universe, and C, mercenary of God. Rarest of demi-boy, agender, biogender, I always knew I was different, barely human. Sometimes I joke I'm a male-bodied spirit. How did the test calculate my incorporeal coexistence? I don't mind a flat chest and leg hair. I'm a sculpture animated with angel wings. Can't you see them? Their gossamer flows around us. I kid. I'm told identity equals flesh, not other kin. Reality is, but the truest I felt was in nothing, by which I mean my body is a vessel for everything. I'm melting from unmade gods. Now I'm going to read the poem that appears directly after angelogender, mainly because yesterday I got a tattoo of the character that I talk about in this poem, Repping in the Borderlands. Their name is Flack. They're the first non-binary playable character I played as in 2019. It was groundbreaking and really inspiring for me. And I really see myself in them, in their badassery, and how they navigate this apocalyptic galaxy full of ragtag cowboy types and mercenaries and aliens. And so I just had to read this poem because of the beautiful face of Flack that's now adorning my upper arm. So this poem is Repping in the Borderlands. Character selection. Magical slum woman, ex-assassin a la Irish grandpa, mech-loving soldier lady, or robot beastmaster. It's obvious. No better way to blaze across moon rocks and galaxy's edge conflict zones than as a gentlemanly AI built to slay. In a universe where mayhem equals fun, the he, she of humans matters even less than good versus evil. Too many interstellar bounties to pick anything besides self. I loot space as a they, them, non-human. A choice to other players is a flare signaling my return home. Even with video game classics like Androgynous Link and Baby Pink Kirby, I've never felt as close to an assemblage of pixels. Or I've never known joy like ignoring a white man and two women to select the me I didn't know existed. And boy, doesn't it feel right to pistol whip alien desperados? My pronouns on their bleeding tongues, my metal vibrating with the hunt. And now my final poem, it's the eponymous poem in this collection, Selamat Sa Intersectionality. And this is where I see everything, all the different aspects of my identity really coming into play in this kind of almost diatribe of American culture. And it's funny because I actually didn't think that this was going to be the titular poem. I wanted it to be something from the middle section initially in terms of sex. But then when I was thinking of a title, I just read this poem again and I was like, you know, this is perfect. This perfectly captures everything that's going on in my book. It synthesizes all the themes and I've never looked back since. And of course, now I have this beautiful title on the cover of my book. I'm really glad that I had that kind of revelation, that awakening later. I mean, it's kind of funny to think that as writers, we have these ideas that think will work, and then we realize later that they're actually not that good of ideas, and there's a better idea down the line. So this poem is Salamatsa Intersectionality. I'm not growing into a man under indigo sky on saffron fields. My swamp hemolymph perspires through Cebuano skin, thick and brown, pliable and brown. Manure-rich air depresses my joints, supple as the wrist flicks of white man signatures of 1776, of ice black, not green tea, of Ben Franklin orgies. I'm not patriotically unmanned, just orientally brown, unhuman. My teeth are wider than mold that dampens my carcass, litter on a saffron field under indigo sky. What remains is gelatinous scat mixed with cowpats plus Bud Light plus cattlemen. I'm not the pioneer unwoman or the Cebuana manic pixie dream girl. My closest relative is Kafka's monster. We bleed kaleidoscopes, scare cowmen, repel suburbia. Our faces don't read West, East, MF. Man buries us in mud, smiles, says God bless America. Well, thank you for listening to my reading. It was such a pleasure. And I'll now turn it over to Ryan and Heather.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Yeah, really great. Thank you. It's so fun to hear your voice bringing this work to life.
We have a couple more questions and then we're going to wrap it up. I was interested that some of your poems reference expectations of religious family members or even the way religion constructs gendered expectations. And I was wondering if religion or the rejection of religion figures into your conversation of gender or LGBTQ acceptance.
Yes, definitely. Both rejection and kind of an acceptance and subversion of expectations of religion. So expectations really come into play in the first section, especially with a poem like Gates of Paradise, and having this kind of Catholic milieu that I'm existing in, I've been trying to fit within the heteronormative guidelines of Catholicism, or at least how Catholicism is often practiced. There are definitely some awesome queer Catholics who exist and who are more accepting, but as an institution, of course, it's pretty heteronormative and queerphobic. And so that was an early part of my upbringing, and I felt like I had to kind of move away from religion to become the queer self that I was. But then as we see in Taken Root, and as we see me playing with expectations of religion like an angelogender, I can kind of use spirituality and faith and these expectations to my own advantage and understanding of my queerness, because I am a very deeply spiritual person. And I do believe in a cosmic energy that kind of exists through all of us and with the world. And I can't imagine not living like that. I just can't subscribe to any organized religion because of a lot of the expectations and practices that end up being made in the name of a religion, when those practices, those prejudicial and pejorative things that people do often in the name of religion aren't really what that religion is about at its core, I feel. And so with angelogender, I was really glad that I got to play with religion and kind of with this religious background that, you know, was part of my life, and to kind of make it my own. And when I even think about my queerness today, I'm very happy to be surrounded by community members who are happily queer and Christian, or queer and insert religion here, or maybe they left religion, but religion and that kind of idea of faith and spirituality is still an important part of how they understand their queerness. And so I feel like for me, I'm thinking about all of these different things, and that definitely had to come in the book. But of course, I wanted to present this kind of narrative of initially butting up against religion, but then using it to my own advantage in the later section. So kind of a move from like ignorance or naivety to subversion and intentional reversal.
That's so interesting. I was just doing some research on Andy Warhol and writing about his connecting with his faith and his orthodoxy in Catholicism, kind of simultaneous with his gay identity, creating different ripples in his artwork and everything else. And so I was fascinated while you were talking about that. I really enjoy the idea of the PDX Queen poem, and particularly how it dissects a binary image speaking to living between and among, rather than solidly in one binary or another. How do you imagine, now, I mean, you know, you have to have a magic ball here for this, but how do you imagine gender roles dissolving or resurging in the next 100 years? Is there a sense of optimism or a sense that this tide is always shifting back and forth between acceptance and refusal?
Today, I'm going to say I'm optimistic. And I say today because I do kind of waffle back and forth. Sometimes I feel like, oh my God, somebody did something that's so sexist or so queerphobic that it feels like we turned back time 50 years. But then sometimes I see really cool things, especially in businesses, and seeing how they're trying to be more inclusive. And maybe that's just me believing that institutions can actually help us. I'm kind of a statist and I actually believe in the Democratic Party. I'm not really an anarchist like some of my friends, much to their chagrin. I do believe in the power of policymaking, right? So I'm going to say that today I feel optimistic, and in 100 years, I envision maybe in a kind of utopian sense that we won't have to go between different racks to get men's or women's clothes, that all bathrooms will be gender neutral. And in fact, I actually had a company that had completely gender neutral bathrooms. It was this central area where there were all of these individual stalls and there was a mirror in the middle, but each individual stall had its own toilet, trash can, and sink. And so it was very individual, but at the same time, it was collective because you can talk to people, shoot the shit in the middle area with the mirrors. And so I was like, why can't this exist everywhere else? It totally worked for us. And nobody cared about pooping next to somebody of the opposite sex, you know? It didn't matter. So I feel like that can totally be implemented soonish. And just seeing how a lot of younger people, like Gen Z and younger, they're really flouting gender roles from the get-go, from their adolescence onward. And I really love to see that, especially with shows like Generation, which stars Justice Smith. He plays a genderqueer character who's just his fabulous self all the time, wears a mix of men's and women's clothes and makeup and all these things that I do as well. And it's just a natural part of his identity. And so I feel like just how quickly younger people are coming into fluidity and gender queerness and flouting those expectations, I feel like they're going to slowly but surely dissolve. But that's, of course, the optimistic part of me, because I know that gender roles have existed for a long ass time, and they can be really hard to undo or to even imagine not existing in a future world, because from the second we're born, we're put into gender roles. Like, I was assigned male at birth. Other people were assigned whatever at birth. And that distinction itself puts you into a system of meaning making that is very binary. And so the pessimistic side of me will be like, how can we really undo that? But optimistically, I want to say, at least from a policy perspective, from acts that companies and individuals are taking to make the world more inclusive, I feel like it's going to be easier to be genderqueer or to be gender fluid or to be trans or to exist in that kind of among and between space that I talk about in PDX Queen.
Yeah, for sure. And my children are Gen Z, so I can echo that completely. I definitely see in their generation a much more open and inclusive kind of attitude.
I have a question about what advice you would offer new poets, particularly queer or non-binary poets.
Oh, that's a great question, and one that I actually haven't really been asked before, so I'm really appreciative of that. It makes me feel like I actually have some authority, so thank you.
Oh, you do.
But I would say just write your truth, because I think so many people want to doll up the truth or avoid it or avoid the messy things. But for me, the most meaningful writing and where I've gotten the most insight about my life and my identity has been from tackling hard truths, like my non-binary identity. Coming into my non-binary identity was something that was parallel to me writing about my non-binary identity. So it really helped me evolve into this version of myself that maybe I couldn't have reached without writing. And so I feel like if you're queer, if you're non-binary, if you're a person of color, or if you're a mixture thereof, I just say lean into it. You're not going to be quote unquote too political. And in fact, I think all the good poetry is political anyway. And I feel like when you're writing about your truths and you're trying to uncover something about yourself or deal with issues that maybe don't look the prettiest on the page, that are inherently messy, I feel like it leads to community, it leads to better writing, and it leads to, I don't know, a happier soul, I guess. That's kind of cliched or that's kind of hokey. But for me, I feel that my soul is definitely sated when I write about issues that maybe I don't feel comfortable talking about or that I can only talk to with a few confidants. And these are usually issues of identity, of my queerness, of my mixed race heritage, that sort of thing. So if any, you know, queer poets of color, for example, are listening to this, I just say, embrace your messy self and write about it, because that's how you're going to grow as a poet.
I love that. That's great advice. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read your work.
Yes. And everybody, please order Dani's book, Salamat Sa, Intersectionality, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales podcast and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.